Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It was just the most massive thing I've ever seen. To tell you the honest truth, I thought, well, we're the only ones left on this planet. Something's happened. We've missed something here.
The fear that went in me when I seen it was just the feeling, I'd say it was fear, but I've never felt that feeling before in my entire life.
It's a weird feeling, like you can't explain it when you don't know. You feel like you're being followed, but you don't know what it is.
We had two to our right, another one in front of us, another one to the left, and another one just across the road, shaking the daylight out of the tree. All we get was a big red eye.
I remember waking up and looking at the end of the bed, and there was a figure there, almost insect-like, and then I blacked out.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Cade Moyer, and you are listening to the Believe Paranormal and UFO Podcast. If you have had an encounter and would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to leave us a rating or review wherever you listen and head on over to our website, believepod.com, and consider becoming a member to get bonus episodes and video content. Tonight, I am joined by a very new friend of mine, Mr. Ben Hurl, and I met Ben down at the Cardwell UFO Festival earlier this year, and Ben had this super, super incredible presentation, but unfortunately, I missed the majority of it because the festival was crazy. I had a lot of things going on, and I caught little tiny tidbits of it. So I had to get him on the show to talk about some of the more weirder UFO cases in Australian history. So, Ben, welcome back to the podcast.
Yeah, Kate, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. I love your work, and it was fantastic meeting you at Cardwell. It's great to meet new people. That's why you go and do these events.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was my first time at that event, and I was very suspicious about how much I was going to enjoy it. And from the get-go, it was just a blast from start to finish. So, you know, you actually hosted the event, and you did such an incredible job of it. You're like this amazing ringleader of, like, handling us crazies and keeping us all in line. So hats off to you for that, mate.
Yeah, thanks for that, mate, because I come from Victoria, and we had no pre-meeting or, you know, just strategy discussion or anything. I just rock up to the hall on the day and it just, yeah, it just happens.
yeah, absolutely. It was like, just get into it. And the speakers were like so varied. You know, you had a lot of people who were like very grounded, some people who were like a little bit in the middle, and some people who had some like very different thoughts to, I guess, a lot of the phenomenon. And it was a really good, like, melting pot of ideas and different points of view, which I thought was, like, a really fantastic outcome for an event like that.
Yeah, it was. Because what they're trying to do at an event like that is they've got to appeal to a whole cross-section of the paranormal UFO market. There's people that have all sorts of different interests in it because it's such a multifaceted phenomenon, you know. So, and that's a big challenge for a festival or a conference or anything like that, is to have something for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this event does it does it very well. And I highly recommend anyone who's kind of been on the fence about going to it to definitely check it out, because I'll be going again to all the future ones that I can possibly get to. I'm kind of ashamed that it took me so long to kind of get around to doing it. But now there's no stopping me. I'm going to be an expo junkie.
Yeah, 100%. And the thing, like, in America, this stuff is there in a huge capacity. And in Australia, we do everything on such a small scale. And I've done conferences before, helped organize them, and it is just hell. trying to make conferences and festivals and expos, bringing it together is just one hell of a stress ball for the organisers. So, yeah, Australia really needs a groundswell of support for these events like Cardwell. And that's as well as my third time going up there. And I just said, I've got to support an event like this because there's no other one like it in Australia.
Yeah.
It has potential. And we need these public live events where people interested in paranormal, interested in the UFO field specifically, can come along and interact with professionals in the industry, experiences, and just really, it really becomes alive for you once you get into that environment.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely agree with everything there. But, mate, what got you into the world of UFOs and the unknown? Because, you know, it's not something that a lot of people kind of just stumble into. You know, some people kind of have an experience with UFO, or they know someone who had an experience. Like for myself, I kind of got into the weird and the wonderful because my dad told me he had an encounter with a Flying Dutchman, of all things.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was a fisherman. So my entire kind of childhood growing up, he was always away at sea. So for him to come back and say, hey, guess what? I saw this ghost ship. That kind of blew my mind and sent me on this road down the world of the paranormal. So that's kind of how I got into it. But what about you? Like, what was that instigator for you to go, yeah, I'm into this. I'm going to go check it out.
It's been an innate part of my life since childhood. So the first books that I ever bought through the Scholastic Book Club back in the early 70s were books on UFOs, the very first books. And it's had this organic part of my DNA from the very get-go. And I always intuitively believed that this universe is a lot bigger and more complex and varied in the way it operates than we can possibly understand. And that Flying Dutchman thing alone would be four episodes with me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's so much you could talk about just with that alone and how that is. So it's always been there in my life. It's riffed along in the background at different periods in time. It's been to the forefront, gone to the background, but it's always been there. And it was around about 2010 when I made the decision that I was actively going to become an investigator. I thought I had done a lot of other things in my life, and I thought now's the time. I want to be an investigator, and I want to be around people who are fascinated by this whole phenomenon. So I went down to Melbourne. I don't live in Melbourne. I live 3 hours east of Melbourne. And I met a guy, George Simpson, who was on your show.
Yeah, George is a lovely gentleman.
Yeah, yeah. And George was having... The only thing in Victoria was George's meetings at the Chelsea Caravan Park with about maybe 15 people turning up. That was the only thing happening in Victoria. And I sought that out from 3 hours away. I drove down and I went to a couple of his meetings. And from there, I met other people. And became the director of Victorian UFO Action, which came out of that. And then we had a state-based group. And I then spent the next 10 years basically coordinating the group, doing current investigations, doing cold case investigations, making videos about all of that. And then we also arranged a couple of conferences, speaks, talk nights, and all that sort of stuff along the journey as well. And I was going to Melbourne once a month from 3 hours away every month to coordinate this particular group in Melbourne at that time. And I had my own experiences also. People say, you've seen a UFO? Yes, I've seen UFOs. That's no question about that. I've had some stranger experiences as well. And so the whole thing from the very genesis was from childhood right through into adulthood, where in 2010 I thought, right, I'm leaping into this in a major way. And that brings us up to this point this evening, sitting here having a chat to you. So, and there would be episode upon episode in all of that. But that's the basics of what got me, of how I got involved.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. Like, there's something just inherently curious about the unknown in the world. And I think I had a very similar, like, connection to it because I was quite young when my father told me that he saw the Flying Dutchman. I was in primary school. So I was very, very young, and I was very much like the same as you, is that as soon as those kind of school book clubs came around, I was always the kid getting the weird books.
That's me.
Yeah.
And I've got a vast collection here.
two peas in a pod, mate.
I actually sought out the book. My primary school had one book on UFOs, and I borrowed it and borrowed it and borrowed it and borrowed it. And then when, as an adult, I thought, I must track that book down. And I actually did. I found it and I bought it. And now it's in my collection, the very first book that got me interested. So it's, it's come full circle in that regard.
Yeah. It's so funny, Ben, because I am on the hunt for two books that exist out there. I kind of know what the covers are, but I just can't remember the name of these books. So I'm always looking for like these like weird facts of the world type of books, because in my mind, one that really sticks with me that kind of made me go down this massive route of the unknown, because it had the Flying Dutchman in this book. It was like this UFO on the cover. I swear it even had Nessie on the front, and it was all kind of like illustrated throughout it, because obviously it was for young children at the time. And yeah, I am on the hunt for that. I would pay just ridiculous amounts of money to get that back into my library. And the second one was this almost tiny pocketbook that somehow knew every alien race that existed and kind of catalogued them within it. And it was kind of like in this Moroni brown little book. And those two, for some reason, just really stick in my mind.
I might be able to help you out with some of that. So after the show, I'll send you a couple of images.
Yes, that would be amazing. I think you're the man to help me out. But so you go from like having this just, I guess, general curiosity about the unknown and kind of knowing that, or having this feeling, you know, that we're not alone in this universe. How do you go from that into becoming a genuine bona fide investigator? Because that's a pretty big leap. You go to a couple of, I would imagine you went to probably hundreds and hundreds of these kind of meetings and gatherings. What was that turning point where you go, I want to turn this into something more official? Is it that you wanted to get something kind of on a record type base, like how Australian Yowie Research, how they got it, like a catalogue and things like that? Is it something like that?
Yeah, we had all those intentions of doing all of that, and we succeeded and failed at the same time. And that was one of our goals, was to create a web page that had, you know, all these cases, links and everything like that to all the work we'd done and everything like that. But as you probably well appreciate, the amount of work that goes into putting all that together is huge. And when you have limited numbers of people, time and cash, that all conspires against you to sort of achieve that.
Mm.
And that was kind of like a byproduct of what I wanted to do from a personal perspective. Like for me, it was like, I want to stand in a field. I want to look at a mark on the ground. I want to look at stock that's been scared and terrified. I want to talk to witnesses who don't know what the hell happened to them. And that was the personal connection for me that made me say, and I want to be able to do this. I want to become a professional in this particular field.
Yeah.
Now, there's courses you can study and all that sort of stuff, but there's not actually any defining qualification to be a researcher. You just have to have the burning interest. Yeah. I think that's the first and foremost thing. Anybody can do this. You don't need, and I hate the word ufologist, because to be an ologist implies that you've studied something at university. To become an ologist, you know, an archaeologist, a biologist, you know, it's the, you know, like, and no one is a ufologist. You don't go to,
you don't
go to Sydney or Melbourne University and study a 5-year course and do a postgrad studies in ufology. So, you know, so that doesn't exist. For me, it was about, you must have the burning passion, desire, and curiosity about it. You must have an open mind, but you must also apply that to some level of scientific analysis as well. So I was never from the point of view of just accepting what I was told or accepting what I was shown or even an agenda of proving that UFOs exist. That's not my interest. I'd never had any intention of proving UFOs exist. I did it because I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't because I had some overwhelming agenda to bring this out to the world and show people. No, I was doing it because I just loved it myself. And that was my initial impetus for getting involved. Now, once I got involved, once we started doing things and you see that all these other people enjoy it as well, that became a really satisfying part of what I did, seeing team members thrive, seeing that everybody was thriving on having the ability to get together and make something happen and hire a city hotel and hire a convention center and fly people in from all over the country. it was amazing to do, to have those experiences, as much as it was terrifying and all that as well at the same time. It was stressful. The net result was fantastic, you know, and we did a lot of really good work in that field. So all of those things sort of compounded from personal obsession, personal interest, through to having a broader goal of bringing it to a team and then bringing it to the public, whoever the hell's interested. Because, you know, in the public, it's like everyone has an opinion on... So, like, not everyone's into UFOs. That's a fact, you know. And when all this stuff comes out, ultimately, it's going to be a lot of people have to have some worldview shifts going on, I can tell you. But for someone like me, you, and other people are out there who listen to this program, it's not a big jump to, you know, if the official word comes out, it's not a big shift for us. But for other people, it's a huge shift, you know, and I've encountered every type of attitude along the way about this topic, from outright believers to outright debunkers and everything in between along that scale.
Yeah.
So you find that, and you can't make people believe or not believe. It's completely up to them, you know. You know that's a personal choice. But one thing I will say is, you know, now I don't care what the weekend's golf results were, right? But everybody has an opinion on UFOs. They exist, they don't exist, or they're not sure.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. And it's funny because, like, UFOs are one of these things that I haven't really encountered it with anything else, because people either believe the Yowie exists or they don't, and they think you're crazy and they kind of move on. But yeah. But with UFOs, I feel like nearly every person has some type of emotional connection to that question.
Exactly.
And exactly. I don't know what it is, and I don't know if it's a realization of we're not the only things in this universe, and does that make me insignificant? Or is it like a sense of fear about it? Or I don't know what it is, but people genuinely have more emotive responses to the, do you think aliens are real? Do you think UFOs are real? And the ones that have the most trouble with it, I usually find kind of chuckle about it and make a laugh and like trying to make you feel silly about it. But, and I don't know if you've kind of found that yourself.
Oh, 100%. I recently went to a work seminar in Melbourne, and they'd said to us, you had to introduce yourself, where you're from, and something about yourself that nobody knew. So I say, you know, I'm Ben, I do this, and I investigate UFOs. Wow, you get such a polarizing response to that from people.
I can imagine.
You get up, is it in a business meeting? You know, and I'll just come out with, I'm loud and proud when it comes to this sort of thing. I'm not afraid to talk about this in front of anybody. And one of the guys just said, he said, that's just not real. He said, that's just a complete waste of time. You know, he says to me, have you seen one? And I go, yeah, I have, but it's not about me seeing one. You know, like, you know, that's great for me, but if I see one, you didn't see one, so that doesn't do anything, yeah. You know? And I said to him, you know, you're entitled to feel however you feel, and I'm not going to try and influence you one way or the other. You know, I'm not pushing something on you here. And then other people go, well, that's really cool, or, well, you know, or everything else in between. So you just get this polarizing response when you say, I investigate the paranormal.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of these things. It's like, oh, I don't believe in it, but I did have this weird thing happen. I'm not saying it's that, but something else happened that was weird.
Yes, or my brother, my uncle, my cousin, my, you know, the people, you don't have to go far to find UFO stories. You don't have to go far at all. You could be at any gathering, subtly raise the topic, and next minute there'll be people talking about UFOs.
Absolutely, you know, which, yeah.
100%. So that is the magic of paranormal, in my opinion. That even though people might say they're not into it or whatever, there's only 7 degrees of separation between them and a UFO report, maybe even less than that. So it's a very common, even if it's not part of your direct daily experience, everybody is not that far away from an experience.
Oh, absolutely. I would even say it's 3 degrees. You know, there's 3 points of contact in someone's life who would have an encounter with something that they can't explain.
Yes. Yeah, it's extraordinarily common.
It is.
And I think that's what people have to realize, that it is such a common occurrence. People say it's an extraordinary thing, and it is, but it's also very common. You know, now I'm not saying that you could go outside and look at the night sky for a month on end and see nothing but satellites, right? And the International Space Station, and that's about all you're going to see up there. And the paranormal is a little strange like that. But if you walk out and take your bins out one night, you could see a flying saucer at low altitude right in front of your eyes. So that's the strangeness of the phenomenon too. It finds you. You don't find it often.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Oh, 100%. And that's something that I always bring up with this podcast, is that the guests that come on here are so varied. Like, we've had lawyers, we've had doctors, we've had a surgeon come on here. You know, they all use like a fake name, because I respect that. But the paranormal, or the, you know, the weird and the wonderful, like, it doesn't discriminate. Like, it doesn't give a crap who you are. If you're going to see something, you're going to see something.
Yes. Yes. That is so true. You are kind of almost destined to this result if you're going to be a part of it. And what I love the most as a researcher and an investigator, I love a witness who had no prior interest in the topic at all. They are my most favorite witnesses at all.
Yeah.
People like, often it'd be things like policemen, farmers, those type of guys. They're too busy. They're not into flights of fancy. They don't follow any of this stuff. But boom, they have an experience. And I've spoken to senior level inspectors in the Victorian Police Force. I've stood in the field and spoken to farmers.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to all manner of occupations and people from all over all walks of life. And they all are basically relating the same thing. I had an experience. I don't know what it was. I want to know what it was. I will probably never know what it was. And that's a very common attitude and response you'll find from people who have experiences. And some people have a one-off high strangeness level experience, which we'll probably talk about tonight, some of those cases. You know, or there's people who have ongoing experiences. You know, there can be a lifetime of experiences.
Yeah.
So this thing is a tapestry that weaves in a very, very unusual, and you cannot put your finger on it in any kind of way. And that's what I love about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing I love the most about the paranormal, I say the paranormal like as this encompassing kind of term for, you know, UFOs, the cryptids, everything, is that the more I learn about it, the less I realize I know. And I think it's just the best thing, because I would love to go into every story and every encounter kind of just completely blind, because for me, it's like the best treat that someone is sharing this life-changing encounter that they've had with me. And every time it's different. Like, it is always different. And that is just the most amazing part about the paranormal.
Oh, it is, you know, and it's a position of trust when someone wants to share their experience with you, whether it's a standing around a barbecue or sitting down with an investigator and a notepad and a video camera, whatever level that is, if someone trusts you enough that you're going to listen to the story, that you're not going to ridicule them and put them down, it's a position of high responsibility. I regard that as anyone who is investigating it. Anyone who is open-minded about it, and people need to be encouraged to bring these stories out. I just wait for all the stories we've never heard about.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly it. You know, like, for every one person that comes forward, there would be thousands of others who are the complete silent majority, which is, I don't know, like, I really hope we see a changing of that tide, because I like to think that, you know, people like us, we create these really safe spaces for people to share their stories. But I completely understand why some people can't, because it's world-breaking events.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, you know, you have a job that obviously job and family are probably the two things that will restrict you from saying something. You know, obviously historically pilots are in that position. You know, pilots having, you're never going to hear about it. Even if they do report it, it's going to go to the airline's records, and you can't FOI an airline.
No. They all sign NDAs, so they can't talk about anything.
They don't have to tell you anything.
Yeah.
You know, the government's responsible for telling you things, and you can FOI a government. You try and FOI Qantas. See how far that gets you.
No way. Private companies completely off limits.
And that's why all the EBE stuff is being dispersed to private industry, so they don't have to show you. You know, like that's pretty clear, I think, at this point in time.
Oh, 100%. And you know, those are all rabbit holes that I could go down with you for hours and hours. But I want to steer us a little bit back on track, because otherwise I'm gonna talk to you for hours, mate. And obviously we're gonna get you back, because you know, we gel so well, Ben, and I feel like any conversation we have is going to be difficult to limit it to our slot. But mate, like I said at the start here, I'm spewing. I missed a couple of really good chunks of your presentation at Cardwell. And one thing that you kind of said there just before really did pique my interest about the high strangeness that kind of goes on with UFO encounters. It doesn't really seem to kind of happen with the paranormal. Happens with Yowies a lot.
Yes.
But UFOs all the time. So, mate, have you got some cases that you can kind of share that kind of go down that route? And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Also, are you wanting more content? Why not become a Believe Plus member? You'll get access to exclusive podcasts and episodes that aren't available to the public. Not only that, you'll also get our regular feed without any ads. Head to believepod.com/plus to sign up today for just $5 a month.
Yes, I certainly have, because I have always drifted towards high strangeness events. Now, you can say, well, all these things are strange. And yes, they are. Every UFO encounter is unique. Yes, it is. Okay. But within all of that, there is a cluster of cases, or more than a cluster, but there's a galaxy of cases that really exhibit high strangeness. Now, what do we mean by high strangeness? High strangeness means that you have got something that has occurred that is almost beyond their ability to make it up in the first instance. So even if you sat down and schemed up a bizarre tale, a high strangeness case would eclipse what you could create on a hoax level. It is just right up there. You'll also have a degree of physical evidence that this high strangeness case actually did occur.
Wow.
Right? So you've got that as well. So they're two key things that I find really interesting. And another thing I really like about high strangeness cases is you'll often get an object or a entity or something that's described in a way that you'll just go, wow, that's something different. That's something really weird. You know, whereas lights in the sky is, which was a majority of what UFO reports are, they're in the sky, people see them. It's a light in the sky, UAP, UFO, whichever one you want to take, you can. Now, there are high strangeness lights in the sky cases, but I tend to find that the lights in the sky cases, whilst interesting, there's very little you can do with them. You know, like once it's been and gone, that's it. But with a high strangeness case, there's a much greater chance to interact with that case, with those witnesses and with what occurred. That's why I love high strangeness. Now, you might say high strangeness might not be that frequent. It is. That's what I'm here to say. Like, you know, now, while it doesn't occur every day, every week, or even every decade, potentially, if you look across the breadth of UFO history, you will see that there are many, many high strangeness cases. And I'm going to kick off with one of my favorites, which I love. Now, it's not from that long ago. It's from 1987 and 1988. So it's not dim and distant, but it's about the time when I was 18, 19 years old, just for a timestamp reference on that. And it's occurred to a man called Bronte Lloyd, which is, I love his name too. Bronte Lloyd was a farmer, and he had a farm just north of Clare in South Australia at a place called Spalding, which is below Jamestown. It's just a little nowhere community where there's just a hamlet grouping of farms, all big farms in this area. You can drive straight through it. And he was a farmer. Now, farmers are, as I said earlier, one of my favorite witnesses to have. They don't mess around. And they know their environment too, which is the other key thing to note about farmers' cases.
Absolutely.
Yes, they know the land, they know the weather, they know the sky, they know everything. So they're very, very good witnesses, farmers. Now, what happened was a series of events that happened to Bronte, and they were all high strangeness. And it started off in 1987, in May, him and his son were seeding a paddock. Now, as they were seeding the paddock, Bronte looked up and noticed that a group of UFOs had come down and were hovering over the top of the paddock silently. About four or five discs or disc-shaped objects were sitting just above the farm, watching as he and his son were doing the seeding. Now, his son decided not to hang around, and he took off. And Bronte was left to finish the job. And he finished doing the seeding, looking up at these objects that just sat silently above the paddock as he did it. Now, the very next morning, he awoke before dawn, and he said he was lying in bed, and it was as though time and space were suddenly suspended. Time and space suddenly suspended. He was aware of a pitch blackness, total blackness, and freezing cold. He couldn't move, and he thought he was having a heart attack. This is the night after seeing these objects above the paddock. He thought he was having a heart attack. He felt himself floating upwards, and he felt something was being pushed against either side of his cheeks, and he felt this intense pain. It was like being stung by insects, and he felt these tubes going into his cheeks. And he grabbed the tubes, and they writhed in his hands like snakes, and he was trying to pull these tubes out of his cheeks. He battled against whatever it was with this action on his cheeks, and something was pinning him down. He tried to reach across for the bedside light switch and kept brushing away at this pressure from these tubes that were in his cheeks. And he knew that there was something close by and was moving around him, just out of reach. He couldn't reach it. And then he passed out. And he woke up later in the morning, and he did not remember that earlier experience. And it wasn't until he was shaving that morning that he noticed that he had three small marks on his cheeks, either cheek, and four more across the top of his nose. Right? So just, I'll leave you with that to start off with. Now, 3 weeks later, in June, it was approaching nightfall, and Bronte and his son were again engaged in ploughing when a bright red light appeared in the sky and then skimmed down to hover 30 metres above some trees near the house. This red light came down, hovered above a stand of trees near the house, and sat there for a while, and then it flew away. Bronte said that he was familiar with aircraft. There was nothing like that. He'd never seen anything like this before, and it just took off. Now, Bronte returned to his house, and his son went away. His son wasn't living with him. He had his own separate property. And Bronte returned home. Now, shortly after he got home, a visitor came calling to the house. Now, the first thing was the dogs went absolutely berserk. The farm dogs went crazy. And he'd never seen them acting that way. They jumped into the air and then they cowered, jumped into the air and then they cowered. And he looked out and there was something near the stand of trees.
I'm getting chills, Ben.
It's a bloody ripping. So it's a ripping tail, I tell you. Now, he thought it was a car because this is dusk. This is around dusk time. Now, 50 metres from the back door was where the stand of 12 trees were. Beneath the trees was a shiny craft, and it was about 4 meters in diameter, 2 meters high, circular in shape, and sitting on a square base, and the object had portholes that went all around it and three large headlights on its front and supporting legs on the ground. Now, as the dogs continued to howl, bark, and jump up and down, Bronte left the house and walked slowly over towards the stand of trees. And he was now aware that he wasn't looking at a car, he was looking at some type of flying apparatus that had landed in his paddock. Now, he fled back to the house, scrambled to find a torch, and he found one, but the batteries were flat, so he goes to find more batteries to put in the torch. And he also called his family, who were actually at a nearby property, and he said to them, "Don't come home. There's something here. I don't know what it is." Right? So the family was scared, and they stayed away. So he's terrified. He's shaken. He slumps into his lounge chair in the lounge room. He just doesn't really know what to do. The next thing he's aware of, footsteps.
Oh, no.
Footsteps. Bronte says, "I won't forget them. They were short, close together, sounded like someone walking on or in plastic. I sat in the chair, staring at the door. I wouldn't open it. I was scared stiff." Right? This is what he says. He got out of the chair and he steeled himself. He walked up and he opened the door. And he had seen that a light had been flicked on in the kitchen. And he noticed two beings moving through the room in a darting action and in a blur. So when they moved, there was a blur. So they'd moved from point A to point B very fast, and there was a blur of as they shot around the room, these two small beings.
Wow.
Now, yes, and it keeps, the whole situation keeps getting more intense. And he then notices from the front door that the dogs are surrounding and barking at something next to the trees. At that point, he blacks out, and he doesn't come to until the family have come home, and he was in this deep, deep sleep. Now, they rang the police, and the police came out, and a search was conducted, and they found that a landing spot under the trees was actually there. There was the impressions in the ground where these landing pads had been, and there was no mistake that a large object had disturbed the ground on the clump of the trees. Strange footprints were also found near the trees where the object had been witnessed. These strange footprints had been found there too. This is in Clare, South Australia, 1987 time period. Now, this is where it gets really, really strange. On Bronte's face developed two large brown patches on each of his cheeks. Now, one would grow larger, the other would shrink. Then the other would grow larger, and the other one would shrink. And then they would move around on his cheeks. These brown marks that look like birthmarks would move around on his cheeks independently into different positions. And he had that for the rest of his life.
Like this farm. It would constantly move.
Yep. They would move independently, grow, shrink, shrink and grow where these tubes had been in his cheeks. And he had that forever. And he's passed away now. And I did track down his grave, and I've got a photo of his grave on my computer. He's buried in the Jamestown Cemetery. And when I get across to South Australia, I'm definitely planning to go to Jamestown and visit Bronte's last grave site where he now is. And his face was actually examined by a biochemist, Australian biochemist called Tom Coote, C-O-O-T-E. And Tom Coote was very fascinated by this strange phenomena that was happening on his cheeks. And they found anomalies in the samples. When they took samples of his skin, they found anomalies in his electrolyte levels, in his actual skin as a result of that. And he had those marks for life.
Wow.
Now, here's a postscript this particular case, that's the Bronte Lloyd case. Now, about an hour's drive from Bronte's property south is a town called Clare, South Australia. Now, in 1989, a man called Stephen Langman, who was a justice of the peace, so he was no idiot, was awoken by a very bright white glow coming from an object on a nearby lounge chair. And the time was 5:40 a.m. And instead of getting up to inspect the light, he lay there and watched as the light came and hovered over his and his wife's feet. This bright white light. Now, their feet were under two blankets and a doona, right? And they could see their feet through the doona. And he moved one foot, and the glow moved to match the movement of his foot.
So there's a sense of, like, intelligence to that.
Yes, yes. This thing was, he described it as something was scanning their feet. And he woke his wife, who was with him, and she reacted just as calmly, and they observed the foot-glowing phenomenon, and then suddenly the light that was over on the lounge chair and the glow over their feet disappeared, and they both went back to sleep. Huh. Now, his wife said that they were not frightened at the time, but a few months later, she had terrible difficulty sleeping, and she was scared to sleep as she had not been able to sleep. She had a lot of trouble sleeping about a month after that event. So this only occurred a year after Bronte Lloyd's strange encounter in the next town down.
Wow.
So, you know, so this is these feet that were being scanned by a glow that would move with the feet and another white light off to the side. So these are high strangeness cases. That's a definition of two high strangeness cases.
I'm not going to lie, that Bronte encounter, like that whole set of high strangeness is genuinely terrifying, and I'm shocked that that is not like a household story for UFO and, you know, potentially like entity interaction.
Yep.
That's nuts. Yep. Like the fact that this guy went through the rest of his remaining life with this condition of, like, this skin condition of these things moving around and changing size, like, that's unheard of. Like, I'm no doctor, I'm no skin expert, but I've never heard of anything like that. Like, that's not normal. Like, that is the definitive of, like, being weird.
Yes, it is my flagship high strangeness case. It's the one that I always lead with, because I love it. You've got this farmer, a man looking for no publicity, no fame, didn't make a dollar out of it. It didn't become it's not a household story. It's not a Westall. It's not a Fred Valentich. It's not a Kelly Cahill.
Yeah.
It's none of these encounters. It's an unknown case. Now it's hard to track down online. You can find some information on it online. There is some information online, but it is not highly available out there. It's just not out there. And it's a great case because it has physical evidence. It has a chain of high strangeness events. It has a credible witness. It is, and it has stuff you just couldn't make up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, it's just amazing.
Yeah. And the fact that, like, you know, there's even potentially an archived police report for the call out there is just even further credence to this incredibly terrifying encounter. I can only imagine the thoughts that, like, that whole Lloyd family was having when this type of stuff happened. Like, the son, you know, obviously bailing while the UFOs are above him. Like, I genuinely don't blame him. The dad is obviously an extreme salt of the earth character to go stuff the UFOs. I need to get this done. Like, this is the family livelihood. I need to do it. Like, that is a genuine hardcore farmer as it comes. I don't know how they go through their whole life with that just being that's their normal, and that's the terrifying part of that, because that encounter just didn't like leave a mark, and no pun intended. Like in that moment, it left a mark for his entire life.
100%. Now I've got another case from Victoria where a farmer was ploughing a field in Wimmera in Victoria, and he had this very similar thing on the tractor, and this red light came down and it flew all the points of the paddock as he was out there ploughing this field. And then he got scared and he drove his tractor out of the paddock and he drove it back home. And this red light had come down and was following him around the paddock. So, yes, it's a very strange thing. Now, just we won't have time for it tonight probably, but in Victoria at the same time, which is not that far from where Spalding and Clare is in the very northwest of Victoria, there's a place called there's a town called Mildura, big city. Then south of that's a big wheat belt. And in that wheat belt, there was another farm that had another series of strange events that riffs off and parallels the Bronte story slightly differently, but also on a broad level, there's similarities in terms of multiple events on a farm with people. It's really incredible stuff.
You know, is that a fairly recent encounter?
No, that's also 1987, 1988 at the same time.
Really? So
it's the same time period as the Bronte one. I mean, I suppose I can share it now on a basic level.
No, let's like dive into it, because I'm pretty interested, because, you know, I've interviewed someone from around that region, and that name of the what you said there was, it sounded really, really familiar. And
all right.
I believe this episode happened in that area, because essentially guy owned a farm. He had a potential craft land in his field, and it left a big mark in there. And he believes that there was entities coming out of this thing, but he was just too petrified to investigate it. Like, his dog jumped off his little 4x4 kind of cart thing, bailed it back, and he's like, "I'm done. I'm out of here." And went back the next day and crop circles.
Well, there's a long history of crop circles in the Mallee.
Mm.
Mallee is the northwest of Victoria, and it has a long history. Now, this I will talk about the one from that area, because it just riffs and connects so well to the Bronte Lloyd story. So, in around the same time frame, there's a little place like Spalding, but it's called Speed, and just west of Speed is another even more obscure area called West Turriff. Now, West Turriff is the actual location of this next one we're going to talk about. Speed's just a little truck stop on the way up to Mildura, and then West Turriff is just a group of farmhouses, eerily similar to the Bronte Lloyd situation. So, now, what had happened there was a farm owned by Max and Nancy Jolly was the farmers who owned this property. And their son Stuart was there as well, and he was on the farm, and the three of them are the central characters in this particular story. So what happened was they had started seeing strange lights at night, and so had their neighbours. The neighbours had been out at night, and they were seeing strange lights in the sky. Now, one morning when Nancy woke, she went outside, and she went to turn the tap on the tank, and she found that the 4,000-gallon house tank was completely dry. There was not a drop of water in it, whereas the day before, the tank had been completely full. Overnight, there's no water. There's no water on the ground. The water's just gone. And she was puzzled. They said they had no idea what had possibly happened to 4,000 gallons of water from their tank. Now, on another evening, the son was home, and he was asleep in bed, and all of a sudden he heard this extremely loud noise, like a jet engine mixed with cicadas. This high-pitched sound. He runs outside the house, and there's just a vacant sky. There's nothing around. Just black night sky. The dogs have run off. The house, the dogs would have come and followed him outside. The dogs have gone. Then, another night, while his mum and dad had gone off to a meeting, all the sheep in the sheep paddock, 700 ewes, 700 of them, right, are all bleating and going crazy. and he walks outside and he looks over to the sheep paddock with his 700 ewes. They are all climbing over the top of each other in the far corner of the paddock, and they're all trying to get away from something.
Oh, wow.
And on the other side of the paddock is this giant golden globe that's hovering there, and it's slowly pushing the sheep all into the back corner of the paddock. And the sheep are just going crazy, and the neighbor's sheep are going crazy. They're all running and jumping over fences as well. All the animals are going stark crazy. Now, his mum and dad and the object takes off. His mum and dad come home. They get a couple of torches. They go out in the paddock, and the sheep are just all frothing at the mouth. They're just terrified sheep. Now, as they're walking around, they also find a wedge-tailed eagle. And the wedge-tailed eagle's on the ground, and it's just totally disorientated. It's flapping its wings. It can't fly. It's like the bird's drunk. And the bird and the sheep were both completely out of sorts. Now, the next day, they went back to the paddock and had seen that the eagle wasn't there, so it must have come to its senses, and it must have flown off. Now, they were due to do their harvesting of the wheat, and the two harvesting contractors come in with the big combine harvesters. They go into the paddock to start doing the combine harvesting. They sit 5 meters off the ground. They stop the combine harvesters, and there's 5 rings in the paddock.
No.
Yep, 5 rings are in the paddock. One's about, I think, I haven't got my notes in front of me, but I think it was around about a 6 meter ring and 2 and 3 meter rings. Now, they had an investigator come up from Melbourne, John Ockertel, who I know John personally, and John came and investigated the crop circles. Now, they found there was actually a vast variety of circles right across the entire farm, plus the neighbouring farms. There was over 400 circles.
Oh, my goodness.
400 circles. Now, when you were in the circle, it was hard ground. Outside the circle is soft, tilled soil. It was in the ring, it was like it had been baked. And it was baked down to about 8 inches. Hard baked ground. You could hit it with a crowbar, and the crowbar would just go
wow.
In your hand.
Jeez, that has to be some intense heat to do that.
Yes, yes. And all the wheat is bent over, not broken, and it's all weaved in a clockwise or slash anti-clockwise pattern.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of typical crop circle, not behavior, but like, yes. I guess, attributes.
Right. The attributes or exactly. That's exactly right. So that farm and that they had a whole series of these type of events occurring over multiple periods, multiple weeks with them and their neighbours. So what I like about that particular case is it's also a high strangeness. There's physical trace evidence, and you've got multiple witnesses, multiple people affected. You know, in Bronte's case, you could say, he's just having a dream. No, he wasn't. He's got these marks on his face that moved around and grew and stuck for the rest of his life. Something happened to that man.
Mm.
You know, got the Jolly family, who I've actually looked into that area, and both Max and Nancy have passed away. They're not around anymore. And the son, I tried my damnedest to track him down, and I'm a really, really, I'm a, like a bloodhound when it comes to looking for people. And I traced him to the Northern Territory, to Darwin, and I found he had an ABN up there because ABN search is a great way to find people.
Oh, the best way.
And, yep. And I did an ABN search, found his name, but I have not been able to track him down. So I know he's in the Northern Territory somewhere. But I would love to talk to him about those experiences that they had on that farm at that time. I even at the time made inquiries in the local area to find out, you know, where the family was, and that's what I found out. And I just kind of had the same feeling that Bronte would be dead too by the time I was getting into this case a few months ago. I thought, I bet he's dead too. And I found out, yeah, no, Bronte's passed away too. So unfortunately, now these both were spoken to by investigators at the time in both cases. Colin Norris in South Australia did a full investigation on the Bronte Lloyd case. And John Ockertel in Victoria did a full investigation on the West Turriff, the Jolly Farm incident as well. So they were investigated. There are some notes out there. You've got to dig to find them. And, you know, John wrote a report on the circles on the Westura farm. So there's some information out there, but like all these cases, it's drifting, it's disappearing, it's being forgotten. People don't know about them now. It's not in the media. And all these great cases, and I'm sure you'll agree they're brilliant, disappearing from the Australian consciousness.
Yeah.
And so I might regard my role as finding these cases, bringing them to the light again. And lots of people like Bill Chalker and Keith Basterfield have done brilliant work, doing a lot of work with Australian UFO cases. A lot of these cases have been investigated by them as well. They've written reports. They've done all that over the years too. But even that information is not commonly available. You know, you have to be following Bill or Keith or dig out their old reports, and you know it's not easy to access this information. Now that's just two and a half of many high strangeness incidences. So another one I want to talk about, which is also equally fascinating. We've got time for another couple,
mate. Let's do one more, because I'm going to have to get you back on, because you're too fascinating of a bloke, and you're a great storyteller, because these two encounters that we've kind of spoken about here, like, they have genuinely blown my mind. And the fact that that jolly encounter, animals don't lie. Like, animals don't lie. If an animal is scared, there is something there. And that is the most telling part of that entire encounter, in my opinion. But, mate, let's finish with one more, because I'm going to get you on for a whole series. We're going to do, like, the unknown Australia.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's do it. I'm keen.
There's a lot of gold here, I tell you.
Definitely.
Now, this time we're going to go to Kempsey. So Kempsey is in New South Wales. It's on the Macleay River. Now, This is long forgotten to history as well too, but Bill Chalker investigated this at the time. This is 1971, right? So we're going back a little further in time. But the Kempsey Flat was an incredible UFO period of activity in the Kempsey district that occurred for about 3 years.
That's a long time. From 1971.
Yep, even up to 1975, actually.
Wow.
From 1971, 1972, 1973, there was an unprecedented amount of UFO activity in and around the Kempsey area. The one we're going to talk about kicked it all off, and it's an absolute beauty. So I did a 3-episode series just on Kempsey on my show. I did a 3 episodes just on Kempsey. That's how full and rich that whole flat is at that time. But just to give you an idea, but we're going to talk about one particular incident, my favorite, from the Kempsey case. So it happened on the 2nd of April, 1971. There's a couple of months in Australia that are important to UFOs. April's one of them. October's another one. Right, so this happened in April. So the reason I say that is because if you're familiar with Westall, Burke's Flat, all those cases, they all occurred in April in different years. So April's always been a significant UFO year, a month, sorry. Now, there's a little town just out of Kempsey called Greenhill. It's just 5-minute drive off, and it's right on the Macleay River. It's only probably 3 blocks of houses, not very big. Now, one of the most extraordinary things happened there on the date of the 2nd of April at 10 p.m. Now, a man and his wife had been out visiting friends. They came home, and about 9:30 they got home, and they're sitting in the lounge room, they're watching TV, and the man's playing with the baby on the floor. He decides, I want to get a drink. So he walks out to the kitchen, doesn't turn the light on, and as he walks towards the kitchen sink, he sees a face staring in through the kitchen window. A face, this white face. Now, the window is 7 feet off the ground, okay? The window is 7 feet off the ground. This white, he described it as a white, circular, round-shaped face was looking in through the window. Now, the man was sucked out through the window. He was, this is reported in the Argus, the Kempsey Argus, and the Kempsey Argus is the source material for all these reports, and they treated it seriously at the time. The new, local newspaper was really, really good. They took all these encounters seriously, and this one is the most outlandish of them all, but it's got supporting evidence.
Wow.
So he claims that he was sucked out through the window by a strange entity. So now what had happened was his wife was still in the lounge room and she heard glass breaking in the kitchen. And she thought her husband had actually broken crockery and glassware left the drain on the sink. She ran into the kitchen in time to see his hips and legs disappearing horizontally through the top half of the window above the sink.
What? So,
yeah, so this then the man fell 7 feet to the ground outside the house, but he only suffered minor cuts to one hand and arm despite the top pane of glass being broken. He'd fallen out onto the bottom of the steps, the steps leading down underneath the window. He fell down on his back 2.1 metres, got up, and his wife was stunned that he wasn't winded, he wasn't hurt, apart from a couple of scratches on his arm, and he ran straight down the driveway. And the terrified man was just totally, like, had lost his faculties. And he ran down the road very upset. He told his wife that he'd seen a strange, small, saucer-shaped face pressed up against the kitchen window, and that he'd been drawn out head first through the glass window by some unknown force. He vowed he would not live in the house again, and he moved to Sydney.
Wow.
He never, ever, ever went back to the house. Now, the Macleay newspaper at the time took photographs of the window. Now, the window is a square window, but there's a wooden bay, there's a wooden strut that goes through the two panes of glass. Only the top pane is broken, the centre wood piece remained intact, and the bottom pane also was not broken. None of the glass fell on the inside of the house. All the glass fell on the outside of the house. There was no glass in the sink, no glass on the cutlery or the crockery. All the glass had been taken out like he had said, like a sucked force been taken out through the window. So whoever had sucked him out was either over 2.1 metres tall, standing at the base, or they were floating above, looking in through the house. To clear the sink in the kitchen, the man would have had to take a running leap through the window, and his trajectory would have carried him well beyond the back steps, where he had landed directly straight down out of the window. He'd fallen straight down onto his back. He was about 160 centimetres tall, and he weighed about 55 kilos, so he was not necessarily tall or necessarily heavy. And he was standing at a sink about 45 centimetres wide. His wife insisted that when he went through the window, he was not struggling or thrashing at all. He was just going straight through the window. And he went through a glass pane 51 centimetres wide, and 25 centimetres high. So it was quite narrow.
That's very narrow.
Yeah, very narrow, very oblong-shaped window. Touched nothing on the sink in front of him. And the next day, he had no soreness whatsoever. So that's one strange case. Now,
that's very strange.
Yeah. Then there's photographs of the window, of the sink. And what I did, being who I am, I Google mapped, walked Greenhill to find the house, right? I went up and down every street, looked at every house, and I didn't actually find it, right? Then recently, before I went to Cardwell, I was reading and I found another snippet on the case, and it had one key piece of information that I hadn't had previously. it said that the house was right down next to the river. Right. So I went back and I searched all the houses along the riverfront there on Google Maps. Found the house. The same windows are there today. They're the same windows with the same little thing that runs across it, the same width. It's a weatherboard house. The weatherboards are all the same size as in the Argus photographs. So I know exactly where the house was, where the incident occurred back in 1971. Now, that was just the start of the Kempsey Flat.
And you know what? In today's age, that house has probably changed hands a couple of times. You can, I guarantee you, Ben, if you would know the address, I probably wouldn't share it here. But you put that address straight into Google, you'll either get a realestate.com listing for that or a domain listing, and you'll be able to take essentially a virtual tour throughout that house.
Yes, exactly right. 100%. Exactly right. That is all so achievable now in this day and age. And I know it's the exact house because there's a photo of the wife standing next to the window. And when you look out the window, you can see the type of trees that are in the background and bang, it's the same trees. So I know 100% it's the right house. It's the house where that incident occurred. Yeah.
That's incredible. And you know, like what a credit to you for like just being such a, I guess a dedicated researcher into finding that. You know, a lot of people really would give up on that type of thing and not do like the house by house kind of approach. And you know, you yourself, like you secretly have this like little piece of incredible UFO history and like the absolute taking off point. What an accomplishment like you must have about that.
Oh, that was really amazing. And just on a side note, that was a small example of me doing that because I also run a true crime cold case page dedicated to a particular serial killing in Melbourne. And I'd watched a news report with the prime suspect and I thought, I'm going to find his house. And his house was a dark stained house with yellow border windows, right? I street walked every street in North Frankston and went down every street looking. It's a very distinctive house, right? Very distinctive. I street walked every house in North Frankston on Google Maps, didn't find it. Did an ABN search. He lived in Seaford, the adjacent suburb. And I street walked in Seaford, found the house. So
you're a genuine online sleuth.
Yeah. So that's just an example of what investigators have to do. You have to, and the other thing I also say is you have to investigate the truth of stories. I want to find the house. I want to find the road. I want to find where it happened. For all the cases I work with, I even came close to finding Bronte's farm. I know it's one of two farms because I went out, I street walked up out of Spalding, 20 Ks, and there's a group of three houses, and it has to be one of those three farms. But I don't know. No, I don't know conclusively which one. I even got onto White Pages Residential, Bronte type search. Nah, there's no one living there now. So I went through all the avenues I could to, and I knew he was dead. I knew I wasn't going to find him, but I was just trying to find if there's one of the family members still had a house there. Nah, couldn't find that. But you go as far as your legs will take you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you what, like you may be surprised, Ben, that someone who listens to this podcast may have a connection because we essentially, with George Simpson coming on the podcast, he found a personal connection through this podcast to kind of get him another step of information for the Valantich case.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. So if anyone knows anything about the cases we've discussed tonight, by all means, share it with you or share it with me. And, you know, that's not a, yeah, happy to always take on new leads.
Absolutely, mate. And look, we might leave it there tonight. I have obviously a billion questions I could ask you about each of these cases. And I know you'll know them inside out, but, you did mention earlier that you kind of did a bit of an online thing yourself earlier, where you spoke about a lot of these cases. And look, this is obviously an open invite to kind of get you back on the show. I'd love to chat your ear off 100 times. And I'm sure the listeners are just completely enthralled with these kind of hidden little gems of UFO history in Australia. And I genuinely had no idea about any of these. And like each one of them has blown my mind and kind of just sent chills down my spine. but where could people kind of find that stuff where you've maybe previously spoken about some of this before? Is there like an online area they can find you?
Yeah, I've just wrapped up my own podcast, which I've been doing for about 18 months on an American network called UNX Network. And my show was called Unexplained Phenomena Australia. So if you go to YouTube and you find the UNX Network page and you go onto their page, click onto their live section, and you'll find all my shows that I've done about Australian paranormal, from UFOs, ghosts to Yowies, done them all. They're all on the UNX Network's channel. And not only will you find my shows when you click on their live section, you'll find all their other great hosts in America that do a lot of shows, because my show was on an American network. And the only reason I've stopped it or put it on hiatus is because I'm writing a book at the moment called Australia's Strangest UFO Cases. So that's why I put my radio show on hold, so I can focus on bringing all this material and all the photos, all the other evidence I've got, material, into a book.
Yeah, and I tell you what, that is the perfect way to kind of like redirect any of that mental bandwidth that you have, because putting it out in a book is going to be so beneficial for kind of UFO history in Australia and obviously the world, because as you know, like, these encounters, they happen everywhere and to anyone. Yes. So the stories and the encounters that you'd write about and you're sharing that book will, I have no doubt, completely help people all around the world kind of just reaffirming what happened to them and, you know, letting them know that they're not alone, they're not crazy, like, they didn't imagine these types of things.
100%. Exactly. And in all my research, people say to me, Ben, where do UFOs occur? And I say, they have been everywhere. And you might think that's a crazy statement, but no, if you research your local area, you research anywhere in Australia, you will find there is a rich UFO paranormal history everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's something, I have a little side project that I'll talk to you about probably off the air, but maybe I can talk about it when this episode comes out. We'll see. But I think it'll be right down your alley. But mate, thank you so much for joining me tonight. It has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Again, I could take your entire night, and unfortunately the beast that is daylight savings is now in effect in Australia, so it is incredibly late where you are, and for me it's quite early in the night. So mate, I do appreciate you for taking the effort and giving me some of your time tonight. I truly appreciate it, and mate, again, it's an open offer to get you on the podcast anytime you want.
Sure thing, Cade. Thank you very much for having me, and no doubt we'll come back and share some more eye strangeness tales.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Believe Paranormal and UFO podcast. If you have had an encounter and you would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to follow us on all our social media outlets, and be sure to join our Discord server to talk to other listeners of the show. You'll find all these links in our show notes. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.